Our next case is 2015-2032, Andrew Foley et al. Versus the University of Dayton et al. Is it Mr. Heather?
Yes, ma'am.
Honorable Chief Justice O'Connor, honorable justices, and may it please the court. My name is Tim Heather. I am the attorney for petitioner Michael Groff. Jared Wagner, counsel for co-petitioner Dylan Prophet, and I will divide our 15 minutes as follows. I will speak for 5 minutes on the first certified question of law, the statute of limitations for negligent misidentification. Mr. Wagner will then address the court for 7 minutes concerning the second and third certified questions regarding the applicability of the doctrines of absolute privilege and qualified privileges. We'll save 3 minutes for rebuttal. I'll be back for 1 minute on the statute of limitations issue, and then Mr. Wagner will be back for 2 minutes on the qualified and absolute privileges issues. The first certified question of law, Your Honors, is what is the statute of limitations for claims of negligent misidentification? Well, we respectfully submit that in Ohio, the statute of limitations for negligent misidentification is 1 year pursuant to revised code section 2305.11A. That is the statute which sets forth a 1 year statute of limitations for defamation claims. Petitioners Groff and Prophet are only mentioned in count 13 of the respondent's 13 count amended complaint. Paragraph 154 of the 155 paragraph amended complaint is the key paragraph here. It reads as follows, quote, Groff and Prophet breached their duty of care to Andrew Foley, Evan Foley, and Michael Fagans by negligently improperly identifying them as being responsible for a criminal act. What we really have here, Your Honors, is in paragraph 154, is a claim sounding in defamation, which is disguised under a banner of negligence.
Counsel, I wonder if we might start with a more basic, I wonder if we might start with a more basic question, and that is, does Ohio even recognize a claim, a cause of action of negligent misidentification?
Our answer to that is, this court has never recognized that. We heard a lot in the brief of the respondent about the Mouse case from 1929 saying this court recognized negligent misidentification in that case. I've read that case and it doesn't even mention those two words. Now, subsequently, some court of appeals without doing any kind of an analysis have said that's what the court found. But if you read the Mouse case from 1929, this court did not make that finding and has never made that finding. So you certainly are within your ambit to find that this cause of action doesn't even exist. And so that would be one easy way to resolve this case. It simply is not a cause of action. But in the event the court does choose to consider—
Let me follow up on that. Counsel, was there any briefing to that effect before the district court?
There was, Your Honor, and the court really didn't address it. It simply certified the three questions, and that was not one of them for this court to decide.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Let me ask you, just based on the facts that I've read, these three young men show up at the apartment of Mr. Goff and Mr. Parfit, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And they knock on the door.
Yes.
And they think that somebody they know lives there.
Yes, that's our understanding.
Okay, and they're instructed that they don't know who they are and, right, you know, leave. And then they come back and do it a second time, right?
In addition to other things, too, Your Honor.
What do you mean in addition to other things?
Well, one of them tried coming in through a kitchen window, hence the burglary charge.
Okay, and that's because they believed that their acquaintance lived there.
That's what we think their belief was, yes.
Okay. So then they call the police, the campus police.
Yes.
And then they identify, they give the description of these three young men.
Yes.
They don't name them by name.
They do not.
Because they don't know them.
Correct.
All right. And they say, this is what happened. Do they embellish it? Do they, you know, throw in a, you know, somebody took a swing, somebody, they don't do any of that, do they?
They do not, Your Honor.
Okay. So they purposely identified these people.
They didn't
negligently, you know, identify them. They purposely identified the people, the three.
Yes, they did. They pointed out those were the three guys that knocked on the door, banged on the windows, one of them trying coming in through a window. That is correct. And, and it was up to the Dayton police to decide what to do with it after that.
And they did.
The Dayton police did follow up on that.
But they didn't do, I mean, ultimately there was nothing done. There was no criminal consequences, correct?
That is correct. The case was ultimately dismissed.
Okay. And were these young men expelled from the university?
That I don't know, Your Honor.
Okay. I'm just wondering what the consequences were here.
I'm not aware of consequences other than defending themselves. I mean, ultimately, they were exonerated.
Okay. But they weren't exonerated through a trial or anything. It was dismissed by the police.
Correct. It did not go through the trial process.
All right.
Yeah. When you say the trial process, were there indictments?
I believe there were, Your Honor. There were formal charges brought against these guys.
By the police or by a grand jury, if you know?
I think the police. I don't think it went through the grand jury process. I may be wrong on that, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
But the point on the negligent misidentification claim is that what the respondents are trying to do is to put form over substance. And this court has long held that when you're looking at a statute of limitations, you must look at the substance, not the form. And we've cited a lead case, Lawyers Cooperative Publishing versus Muthing from 1992, where this court stated, if I may briefly quote from this court, in determining which statute of limitations should be applied to a particular cause of action, this court has held that courts must look to the actual nature of the subject matter of the case rather than to the form in which the action is pleaded. The grounds for bringing the action are determinative factors. The form is material. And we all know why they brought it negligent misidentification, because they missed the statute by 2 days to bring a defamation claim. If they file it 3 days before, our people are getting sued for defamation, but they missed it by 2 days. Hence, they had to get creative. And we have the 12th District Court of Appeals in Wilkerson versus O'Shea just addressing that specific provision, saying, a party cannot transform one cause of action into another through clever pleading or an alternative theory of law in order to avail itself of a more satisfactory statute of limitations. And in that case, they cited this court's ruling in Love versus Port Clinton, a 1988 case. In Love, the plaintiff had claimed that a police officer had negligently subdued him. The Love court held, if I again may quote from this court, quote, where the essential character of an alleged tort is intentional, offensive touching, the statute of limitations for assault and battery governs, even if the touching is pled as an act of negligence. Here, Your Honors, the essential character of the negligent misidentification claim is defamation. You must, if you're making a negligent misidentification claim, you must defame somebody. You can't not have that. That is a central component of it. And so consequently, the courts have said you must look at what the bottom line is here. The bottom line is defamation. And yeah, they can call it negligence because they were 2 days too late to call it defamation. But this court needs to see through that, just as the Court of Appeals in Cromarty versus Goolsbee held. That's a 2010 Eighth
Counsel,
District case.
Counsel, if I may, you're inviting us to accept an argument that this is defamation and it is not misidentification. Why?
Well, the elements are different between the two, but you have to have defamation in a negligent misidentification. You can't negligently misidentify somebody without defaming them. And that's really what the crux is, and what this court has always said, as well as numerous courts of appeals, you gotta look at what the substance is here. And that is what the substance is. And
well, counsel, I just wanna walk it through maybe common sense. Was this a misidentification?
We don't believe it was. We think that our clients did not misidentify these guys. How they were able to get exonerated, I don't really know. But if you were to depose our clients today, they would still stick by their word that it was not misidentification, contrary to what is represented.
But Counsel, you're well into your time of your co-counsel
yes,
and your rebuttal.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Just very briefly, I would just conclude saying that we must look at the substance, not the form. And the substance in this case is defamation, and consequently, the one-year statute should apply. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, just for your information, you've got a total of 5 minutes left out of your 15, so you can allocate that however you want.
Yes, ma'am, Your Honor. Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Jared Wagner, and I'm going to speak quickly since I have 5 minutes to address two certified questions of law on absolute privilege and qualified privilege. The absolute privilege is recognized in DeCorpo versus Sweeney by a unanimous decision from this court, how that statements made to a prosecutor implicating another in criminal activity are entitled to an absolute privilege because it's part of the judicial proceedings. The reasoning in DeCorpo was that making statements to a prosecutor such as that starts a possible and potential criminal investigation into criminal activity. So if a judicial proceeding starts by discussing possible investigation of crime to a prosecutor, why would it not start with also to a police officer? And the majority of the courts who have considered DeCorpo, both state and federal, have held that it applies to statements made to police officers. And it only makes sense because both are members of the executive branch, and the decision in DeCorpo was based on judicial proceedings starting with actions that could potentially, don't have to, set in motion the process of
but
criminal investigation.
But the qualified immunity, it applies to defamation, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
And you want to use that same cloak to cover negligent misidentification, and you also want to extend it to police as opposed to prosecutors.
It's actually the absolute privilege. The qualified privilege is a separate issue. We don't think you even get to if you find absolute privilege.
Okay, well then you want to do the same thing with absolute privilege. It applies to defamation, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And you'd like to have us judicially apply it to negligent misidentification. Correct?
Yes, ma'am, Your Honor.
And you want us to say that the that privilege extends not just to judicial officers, but to police.
Correct. And multiple courts have applied absolute privilege to crimes, or not crimes, torts other than defamation, including this court in DeCorpo, which said they would decline the invitation to define whether or not there was a tort for false light invasion of privacy, because it held all civil liability was gone with the absolute privilege, so it wouldn't be appropriate to determine whether a separate tort, not defamation, existed. And so basically they want to put form over substance. They want to say, well, but how we frame our tort that we bring against you is how the privilege should be evoked. But the privilege is based on the need and the public policy to put in place that you encourage reporting of crimes and investigation of crimes. That public policy is based on the nature of the communication, not the nature of the tort that's brought against the person. So if you're not immune from all civil liability, then the privilege goes away. There would be no privilege. They could just basically bring any other claim, intentional infliction of emotional distress, or a multitude of other claims, which courts have applied this privilege to. And you also create a prosecutorial loophole if you have that such statements are privileged when made to the prosecutor but not to the cops. And more well-to-do politically connected persons may be able to call the prosecutor and report crimes. So this would disparately affect most of the common people who report crimes usually to the police. So the absolute privilege should apply both to crime or reports to the prosecutor and the police officer, both of whom, again, are members of the executive branch. I'm going to end because there's about 1:30 left of my time.
All right, you can use that for rebuttal.
Yes, ma'am, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices. My name is Michael Hill. I represent the respondents and plaintiffs in this case, Michael Fagans, Andrew Foley, and Evan Foley.
And my understanding is that we're just starting out. There's a very different story on what happened at the residence here. Your folks say they knocked on the door. They were informed that the person didn't live there. The door was closed. They knocked on it again. There was an offer to say, sorry, I bothered you. I'm going to shake your hand and we're going to part as friends, even though nobody knew each other, correct?
Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor.
And then the other story is that they were, your clients were, for want of a better word, obnoxious, bothersome, and somebody tried to enter the home through a kitchen window.
That's exactly right, and that's what was reported to the police. And just to clear up the facts a little bit, I don't want to get into the facts, but there were indictments here for robbery of serious felonies. There was a proceeding. There were preliminary hearings in front of a judge in Montgomery County. It was determined that there was no probable cause for the arrest. These young men, one was an MBA student at Dayton, his brother, who was a university student at Fairfield, who was visiting, looking to transfer, and another University of Dayton student were all thrown in the Montgomery County Jail for a number of days.
Was there a malicious prosecution count in your...
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
There was not a malicious prosecution count because the once the information and identification was given to the police officers and an accounting of what happened, from there the decision to essentially bring these charges were brought by ones other than the petitioners in this case. So there would be no malicious prosecution. In addition, to clear two matters up, there was a suggestion that this case was filed 2 days after the statute of limitations for defamation. That's just factually not correct. It was actually filed 2 years, about 2 days short of the 2-year statute of limitation for a personal injury claim, which is what we believe this falls under, as well as the Section 1983 claims that are currently pending in the federal district.
Okay, Mr. but those Hill. Are against the police and the university.
That is correct.
Okay, we're talking about the defamation claim against these three young men.
No, two young men. The identification claim.
Misidentification, but the argument here is that defamation is an element of the negligent misidentification.
Yes, that has been discussed here in the briefing, both in the federal level and
here.
Would
you agree with that?
I would not agree with that. What I would agree to is that communication or an identification, pointing out a person, does fall, is certainly an element of negligent identification or misidentification.
But it has to be a negative consequence, which is what the defamation.
It does, but, Your Honor, the defamation claim includes only reputational harms. And as this court in the Mouse case that was just discussed decided in 1929, that there's a loss or a confinement of liberty, which is a personal injury in addition to a reputational harm. In this case, it's individuals being thrown in jail, being in jail for a matter of days. There is a reputation component to that, but that is a personal injury.
But this is a case regarding negligent misidentification.
Yes, and it's been termed both.
And the individuals who made the report did not misidentify the individuals who were at their home. So could you help me with the...
I understand
if you were arrested for this, that you weren't there, we could say that might be misidentification. But it occurs to me that the facts here are that the individuals who either knocked on the door or attempted to break in a kitchen window, whatever happened, I don't understand that, it's still in dispute, but they were the same individuals.
That's correct. So let me just...
So is it misidentification or not?
The terminology that's been used throughout the courts is improper identification and misidentification. The nomenclature hasn't been very good, but the elements of the claim are the same, and that's that when you're reporting someone to the police for the commission of a crime, there's a level of care. There is a duty of care.
Yes.
And the breach of the duty of care comes about when you recklessly or just knowingly or without any regard point somebody out, or when you falsify.
Yes. So it surely wouldn't want to identify the Chief Justice as the perpetrator of this offense. That might be a misidentification.
It would be.
But in this case, we have the individuals who allegedly perform these acts.
And you're absolutely right, Your Honor, and that's why I
so
say the nomenclature
that
hasn't
that
been
isn't
good.
A misidentification.
It's a improper identification, which throughout
What's
the court.
What's improper here is that you say the report of what these three young men did is improper. It's not the fact that these three young men were on the property and had the encounter. It's you disagree, and there is disagreement here, as to actually what happened.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so the three people, though, there's no doubt, your clients were on this property.
They were on the property.
They weren't then misidentified to the police as the three that knocked on my door.
What the information that was given was embellishment and was false.
Well,
and
then isn't that defamation?
It is not your a defamation.
So if
claim
I
could
allege
have been
that
brought.
You did something and I'm malicious in that and suggest that you are committing some act that you really didn't commit, mm-hmm. isn't that the maliciousness which forms the basis of the defamation claim, not the misidentification?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not disputing that.
Well, I'm having trouble distinguishing between your argument.
Okay.
I don't understand, because I think the cause of action that you're now telling us about, in response to the questions and answers to the chief, goes to defamation.
Your Honor, the courts have been clear, and it is set out in the briefing, that there, in an occasion like this, there are two distinct claims that can be brought. One is for defamation, and one is for negligent improper identification, or also termed misidentification. In this case, I do believe that a defamation claim could have been brought.
Can you bring a defamation claim?
Currently? No, because of the statute of limitations.
And when did that statute expire?
1 year after the event, which would have been March of 2014. This case was filed in 2015.
When did you file your civil case?
2015.
So it had expired.
It had.
They were correct, the respondent, or excuse me, petitioner, saying that the defamation, the potential for a civil action based on defamation has expired.
It had expired for nearly a year.
But counsel, okay. That's not what we're here for today, is it?
It is not, Your Honor.
I'm looking at what the federal court has asked us. And the federal court has asked us statute of limitations on negligent misidentification. And I assume you'll wrestle with that over in federal court and have a good day. My question to you, sir, is the doctrine of absolute privilege applicable to negligent misidentification suits such as what you filed?
It is not, Your Honor.
Why not?
Your Honor, I think this court has been clear that absolute immunity or absolute privilege is specific to judicial proceedings. I believe the rationale behind that, and the court has been very clear in the DeCorpo versus Sweeney case that defendants discussed, that given the risk of abuse or the risk of expanding this absolute immunity, which includes claims for it cannot be defeated with malice, with intentional falsities, anything else. It's absolutely privileged, should be done so very narrowly and carefully. What defendants are asking is that any time someone makes a statement to the police, regardless of whether it's knowingly false, regarding if it's intentionally intended to mislead somebody, there is no suit. It's not a defense. It would be complete privilege. It's protected. Nothing could be done about it. And we know, and this is set out in the briefs, but I don't know how articulately, we know that that's not the case, because the legislature has carved out specific immunities for specific people reporting potential crimes to the police.
What about the third question, then? Is the doctrine of qualified privilege applicable?
It's not. Again, that is specifically a defamation defense. This is a negligence claim. The issue of whether this negligence claim exists or doesn't exist is not before this court. And the reason that does not apply is, one, it's a defamation claim, but two, asserting or allowing this qualified privilege in a negligence claim also brings in a lot of confusion. It brings in confusion because now you're adopting part of a defamation defense or privilege to a negligence claim. And the next question is going to be, well, does it apply to other negligence claims? What else from defamation is going to apply to certain negligence claims or other kinds of torts? And there's going to be no framework for the lower courts to decide.
Mr. Hill, let me interrupt you and ask whether or not you have a response to the question first posed by Justice French, whether or not Ohio recognizes negligent misidentification as a recognized tort?
The answer, Your Honor, is it does.
Okay, and what is your authority for that? I'm not able to find any case where this court has declared it. I know that the 6th, 8th, and 10th District appellate courts have referenced it, but this court has never spoken to it that I was aware.
You're right. The first time and only time this court has addressed what has been referred to subsequently as negligent improper identification or misidentification is in the Mouse versus Central Savings and Trust.
Yes, but that gist of that action was the dishonor of a check, which resulted in the depositor's incarceration, right?
Well, and it was actually specifically the reporting to the police of a check that had bounced or dishonored when there were sufficient funds and the lack of due care in reporting that to the police.
And if I understood Mr. Heather's argument, he suggests that the words negligent misidentification don't appear in the opinion.
That's true. They don't. What they say is there's a duty of care that improperly reporting a crime or breaching that duty of care is a specific cause of action, distinct, not discussing defamation.
But isn't that cause of action for the dishonor of a check, and shouldn't we limit it to those facts? Because it seems like we're far afield of it here.
No, Your Honor, because I don't think that there would be a reason to limit that case to the dishonor of checks, because what the court refers to is the injury suffered is the confinement of a person's liberty and humiliation of being taken to jail.
So you read the recognition of this tort of negligent misidentification as emanating from Mouse?
I do.
Okay. I understand your
counsel,
argument.
It strikes me that as often occurs in the law, when you have a fact pattern that doesn't fit neatly in the things we're taught in law school, isn't really the claim negligent misidentification of a crime committed?
Yes.
That's the problem. It's not the individuals.
That is exactly right.
It's the reporting that these individuals committed certain crimes on our property.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's what the miss is. It isn't that we were mistaken that Joe and Mary were the people there. We were mistaken as to their purpose of being there. They weren't there as trespassers. They weren't there as burglars. They weren't there to rob us. They were there because they knocked on the wrong door. And I don't know, were they a little high at the time or whatever, which would also go into one's understanding of why people hit on the wrong door. But isn't that really what the claim is?
Yes.
You negligently misreported a crime by these individuals.
Yeah, that is the sum and substance of this claim, regardless of what it's been called.
It seems to me that's the language hang-up that's going on in this case.
That's exactly right, and I think if we flesh out all of the cases, and no court has in the state of Ohio said this claim
doesn't
exist. And
does it make any difference that you could look at it, as counsel has said, well, you could never have one of these if you hadn't also defamed. Well, you might have done a lot of things.
Right, and you could have a defamation claim without this because the person wasn't arrested and wasn't thrown in jail and had these other issues. Just like you can oftentimes have multiple different torts arising from the same conduct. And you don't have to bring both, you may bring one. And the fact that one exists doesn't mean that you have to get rid of the other.
But how is it distinguished from defamation? That's what I'm trying to understand. As I listen to Justice Pfeiffer, when you're falsely stating to the police what the actions were, that sounds to me like defamation. How are you saying that negligent misidentification differs? Why is it separate from defamation? I don't get that.
Your Honor, I'm out of time, but if I could just answer your question. The difference is, and the courts have set out the elements of a negligent misidentification.
Where?
They've set it out. It's identified in the briefing, but it's also been set out in numerous lower courts.
No, but I mean, where have we set it out?
Oh, you have not set it out.
Okay.
But the elements have been recognized
by all
the courts.
What are the elements in negligent misidentification?
The elements in negligent misidentification include or are limited to negligently, or there's a duty of care that everyone has to be careful in reporting a crime. Breaching that duty, resulting in an arrest, resulting in confinement, resulting in damages. The difference between a defamation claim, and just to use the facts of this case for example, there are different harms involved. If they would have just gotten a loudspeaker, these individuals, and said they broke into my house, they wouldn't have been arrested necessarily. They would have suffered, you know, some reputational injury, but they wouldn't have been thrown in jail.
But doesn't that approach either false arrest or malicious prosecution, torts that we already recognize in Ohio?
You do recognize those in Ohio, but they wouldn't have been recognized under the circumstances of this case because the arrest was not made by the individuals,
well,
the petitioners in this case.
The arrest was made by the university in reporting it.
Based on the misreporting of information. So there would be no false arrest claim.
Malicious prosecution would have.
There would not have been a malicious prosecution case because they did not actually initiate the proceedings. So this is.
Defamation doesn't cover it in your view.
It would not have covered all the harms. That's correct.
So defamation is not an element of negligent misidentification?
I believe the claims are often the same, but no, I would not consider it to be an element of the claim.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, so Mr. Wagner will use all of our rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honors. First, I'd like to say one of the reasons malicious prosecution and false arrest weren't brought is because those also have a one-year statute of limitations, as does defamation. And to address the issue of the Mouse case and whether or not this court has ever recognized negligent misidentification.
Well, now, wait a minute. That's a little disingenuous. If you couldn't bring it against your clients, period, because they're not the police, then the statute of limitations as to your clients on false arrest just don't, so what?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, the false arrest, and you can bring a malicious prosecution against a person for where your actions result.
Well, did they file a charge, your clients?
Well, I would argue that it wouldn't be the initiation of it, but it certainly could be brought. I was just pointing out that that's also a one-year statute of limitations.
Well, but what difference does that make? Well, it seems to me it has no point in this discussion.
Well, I apologize, Your Honor. I was just trying to point that out, that they couldn't have even brought it. So their actions saying that they didn't initiate it really didn't have any bearing either. But the Mouse case, though, does not stand for the proposition that there's negligent misidentification because the defendant was not even the one who reported the crime to the police in that case.
Well, the Mouse case is how old?
1929.
Yeah.
And the late
this is, what is this, 2016, am I right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so we're asked, in today's environment, do we recognize the tort of negligently misidentifying people as having committed crimes?
Yes, sir. And my, I would say
and,
no.
And why would we look back to 1929 to answer that question?
Well, petitioners, or respondents are the ones looking back to 1929, because as we cited, the majority of our sister states that have addressed this issue, a lot of them have held there is no such tort. Bring it as a defamation claim. So that is the point we had raised in this, and that as a precursor determining what the statute of limitations is, which we believe is 1 year, the court can determine, well, if there's not even a claim at all that exists, well, then we don't even have to determine what the statute of limitations is. Because that's a presupposition of a statute of limitations is that the claim first exists. Even though that's not one of the specific certified questions of law. So that's why, and it was, we raised that issue.
Well, but isn't that really the question? Does the claim exist or doesn't in Ohio?
Yes, sir, that's for the first certified question of law, but although I believe, Your Honor, that one of our main arguments is that because the actual essential element of negligent misidentification, it's a defamation claim where the person gets arrested. He distinguishes it based upon the outcome of what the defamation causes, not just the defamation itself. That's the big distinction between defamation and negligent misidentification.
If this had been filed within the year as a defamation claim, could the petitioners or the plaintiffs have received all of the remedies that they are now requesting?
I would still argue there'd be absolute privilege for that. Within the 1 year. Certainly the statute wouldn't be an issue.
So if we recognize the negligent misidentification, we would not only be looking at the statute doesn't apply, the one-year statute doesn't apply, but we would also be saying that the plaintiffs could receive a greater remedy.
I believe you could find that there's negligent misidentification just because it's called that, but it's still subject to the 1 year because it's essentially a defamation claim. But if you determine that it's not 1 year, then, or that it exists and it's not 1 year, then we would have to go to the absolute privilege issue, the second certified question of law, to determine whether or not the DeCorpo absolute privilege extends to police officers, which we believe it does, and applies to this claim, or whether it's limited simply to defamation. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.